You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Veterans Day was created as a time to pause, reflect on, and celebrate the many sacrifices made by the men and women of our armed forces and their families. Since 9/11, over 2 million American soldiers have been deployed to fight the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And to date, nearly 5,800 men and women have died in those two conflicts, and the number who have suffered physical injuries is approaching 40,000. We've been engaged in both wars for nearly a decade, and in his latest book, Richard E. Rubenstein examines the rationales offered for these and other conflicts, and he proposes the essential questions that we should have asked before we began them. Reasons to Kill, Why Americans Choose War is published by Bloomsbury Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Richard E. Rubenstein, who is University Professor of Conflict Resolution and Public Affairs at George Mason University, to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
During the 169 years between 1776 and the end of World War II, the U.S. spent just 19 of them at war with other nations. But from 1950 to 2010, we spent more than one-third of those 60 years at war. Why have things escalated so much in the past 60 years?
Well, it's a good question. I wonder to the about the extent to which war now has become normal. For a long time, our tradition really in America was to avoid going to war unless it could be justified on grounds that were validated by our civil religion. We went to war because we felt that we had a right to defend ourselves, or we went to war because we felt impelled to embark on a moral crusade, or we went to war because we thought there was no other alternative. But lately, these justifications for war are kind of washing away.
But we went to wars that are hard to defend, like the Mexican War, the Spanish-American War, and we used some of the similar rationales that we have used in the last 60 years to explain why we were going to those wars.
Well, very much so. Those rationales, in many cases, and you've just named two, which were used to generate enthusiasm for wars that really were unjust and unnecessary. But if you ask what's changed in the past several decades, one thing it seems to me that's changed is that we've become a world empire. So that now, instead of self-defense, meaning that American people were endangered on their own territory, self-defense means that the latest imperial outpost is endangered. And this tendency to expand the justifications for war, to expand them and thin them out, characterizes a lot of our recent war making.
We've become, to some degree, the policemen of the world, or we did for a long time.
That's right.
Well, has it become easier to sell the American public on the need to engage in these kinds of wars?
You know, I think yes and no. Yes, it's become easier to develop an attitude of toleration, if you like, for war. No, people have not been sold. I mean, latest polls show still more than 60% of Americans disapproving of the war in Afghanistan and believing that it should not have been fought.
But we have seen strong support initially behind going to Korea, Vietnam, Afghanistan, Iraq, and then people start questioning the rationales for those wars. And as they drag on, of course, they become less and less popular.
That's true.
So is it just a matter if you go in and do it really quickly and you have an immediate success, then people don't question the wars?
Well, I suppose so, in the sense that if you have an immediate success and that's a walkover, for example, Grenada, you know, or Panama, people tend not to question those wars.
Although you could if you look at the circumstances.
But, you know, one of the findings of my book, of my research in American history and the debates that we always have between pro-war and anti-war forces, I mean, one finding is that we do have these debates, that it's very, very rare that we have a war without a substantial anti-war movement. World War II is the great exception. That Americans can't really be sold and are not generally sold on war on the basis that it's good for business or on the basis we need some more territory or on any of the other bases that some people would call realist. We are only sold on war if we think it's justifiable. We're basically a religious people. even a secular religious, like secular slash religious people. And you have to convince us that the war is morally justifiable or we generally will not agree to fight it.
Well, you propose four questions that should be asked when self-defense is proposed as a justification for war, and that's the justification we hear most often. What are those four?
Well, when you the question when self-defense is proposed is really the essential question is, are we really in trouble? Are we really in danger? And in order to answer that question, you need to look at the self. What's the definition of the self that's being defended? Is it American lives on American soil? Well, I tell the story to begin with of the Seminole War in the early 19th century, which was fought by Andrew Jackson before he became president.
Another war that's difficult to justify.
Oh, absolutely.
Now.
Well, the justification was that Indians in Florida, which was then Spanish-owned, were attacking over the frontier into Alabama. But then you look into it and you find out that what was really going on was that slaves were escaping from the South. The Seminoles, who were not racist, were welcoming them as Seminoles. And the Southerners were raiding the Seminole settlements in order to reclaim what they felt was their lost property or their stolen property. So that when Jackson said America is under attack, what he really meant was the slave system is under attack. And then you have this tendency to expand the doctrine of self-defense to where it means domestic institutions, then it means American ideals, and finally it means, whoever happens to be fighting in a place like Iraq, even if they have no business being there.
Have we ever gone to a war where we were really defending ourselves other than in response to Pearl Harbor?
Well, I think that World War II was a defensive war, not just because of Pearl Harbor, but because the number two and three economic powers in the world, Germany and Japan, were fascist and were bent on making their system the world system. The fact that that war was, in my opinion, defensive and could be justified, however, has been used to create a kind of metaphor which is used to justify all sorts of wars that have nothing to do with World War II. Everybody that we don't like is the new Hitler. Everybody that we don't like is bent on taking us over.
Well, but the Cold War was fought that way, although it didn't really heat up. There were some skirmishes because we said that the communists wanted to take over the world.
Yes, that is what we said, and it was never true.
Wasn't the self-defense rationale a reasonable response to 9/11 because Afghanistan was harboring the people responsible for it?
Well, at the time of the the attack on Afghanistan, I went on local radio and television in Washington, D.C. and tried to point out that the Taliban was not al-Qaeda and that if our aim was to get al-Qaeda out of Afghanistan, there were ways to do that without trying to overthrow the government of Afghanistan and put ourselves in the position of having to occupy the country, which you could see didn't take an advanced degree to see that that was going to be a disaster and it was going to be basically impossible. So we're still in that same position. That is to say, we're in Afghanistan saying that we're there to protect ourselves against al-Qaeda, but it's becoming clearer and clearer that the Taliban will not allow al-Qaeda, which has left town, to return if we can make peace.
We have a clip from President George W. Bush talking about the reasons for invading Afghanistan. I'd like to play that now.
Good afternoon. On my orders, the United States military has begun strikes against al-Qaeda terrorist training camps and military installations of the Taliban regime in Afghanistan. These carefully targeted actions are designed to disrupt the use of Afghanistan as a terrorist base of operations and to attack the military capability of the Taliban regime.
That was that speech was on October 7, 2001, when 9/11 was still fresh in our minds. And did many people protest at that point?
No, not many people protested at that point. In fact, one of the officials of my university and I co-authored a letter pointing out that we didn't think an attack on Afghanistan was necessary or a very good idea, and it was never run. The Washington Post decided not to publish it. So there was not much protest. It's kind of hard to make your voice heard at a time like that, and mainly because, just as you said, people were terrified and they were angry. So I had the experience of going on a local radio show, a network radio show, not long after 9/11, and saying that the 9/11 attack was obviously inexcusable, vicious, inexcusable, monstrous attack. But that if we wanted to understand why it had happened, we would have to look at our own behavior in the world, as well as the behavior of the bad guys, and ask, what have we done to alienate so many people in the Islamic world?
And I'm sure a lot of people were upset with you.
A storm broke. And finally, I tell the story in the book, the president of my university called me, a lovely man, a conservative man who doesn't agree with me about a lot of things, but he called up and said, Rich, I want to tell you that your job is okay, because he had received dozens of phone calls asking for my head after I had, and that's really all I had said on the show was, we need to look at ourselves too. Maybe it was too early to say that, but it's still difficult, though.
I'm going to get some angry mail right now.
I'm sure
people are writing it, angry notes to our comments on our show page as we speak, but that's okay. Richard E. Rubenstein is my guest. His latest book is called Reasons to Kill, Why Americans Choose War. It's published by Bloomsbury Books. Another example of the self-defense rationale was used by Lyndon Johnson after an alleged incident, the Gulf of Tonkin. That was the justification for a major escalation of our activities in Vietnam. And let's listen to a little clip from him.
My fellow Americans, as president and commander-in-chief, it is my duty to the American people to report that renewed hostile actions against United States ships on the high seas in the Gulf of Tonkin have today required me to order the military forces of the United States to take action in reply.
Now, I think historians have discovered that there probably wasn't such an attack. Was it totally manufactured to justify going into that war?
Well, it was about 90% manufactured. It's a terrible story, really, and I'm surprised that not more people know it. You know, we should all know the story. Because the night before the alleged Tonkin Gulf attack, U.S. destroyers were actually accompanying South Vietnamese raiders in raids on North Vietnamese territory, and that was totally covert. There was no publicity about it. We weren't supposed to be doing that, but we were doing it. So nobody could talk about it. PT boats came out, apparently, to challenge the destroyers on that night, and then when the destroyers turned the guns their way, they ran. They fled. No torpedoes were fired. The next night is when the Tonkin Gulf attack was supposed to have taken place. But Johnson himself, Lyndon Johnson himself, said later on, those guys must have been drinking something. I don't know what they were firing at. All we know about that night is that the destroyers, the Turner Joy and the Maddox, began firing at something or other, and the whole rest of the story was cooked up. It was cooked up in order to get Lyndon the authorization from Congress to do what he liked in Vietnam.
Well, self-defense was one of the reasons cited for going to war with Iraq, although Iraqi ties to 9/11 were dubious at best. So is this what you do when you're trying to convince the public that we should go to war? Just say, well, this country was responsible for an attack on us?
This is one thing you do. I mean, you self-defense is the easiest and most ubiquitous reason for war, given for war, although there are other reasons, moral duty, humanitarian,
we'll
duty,
get to
and
those.
So forth. It's not, you say dubious at best, and that's putting it mildly. There is zero evidence of any Iraqi involvement, of Saddam Hussein or anybody else in Iraq being involved with al-Qaeda.
Richard E. Rubenstein is University Professor of Conflict Resolution and Public Affairs at George Mason University. He's the author of 7 books. Most recent, Reasons to Kill, Why Americans Choose War, from Bloomsbury. We'll continue our conversation after this. We're back with Richard E. Rubenstein, whose latest book is called Reasons to Kill, Why Americans Choose War. It's published by Bloomsbury Press. We talked about self-defense as the first justification, but there are some others. On several occasions, including Iraq, we've heard about the evil enemy. So-and-so is an evil aggressor whom we must either appease or defeat. We become Chamberlain if we don't do something about Saddam Hussein.
Right. Right.
Or Slobodan Milosevic. Now, on the other hand, these people are awful people, aren't they?
Yep, they certainly are. But there's a difference between, let's put it this way, there's a difference between relative evil and absolute evil. There are lots of people in the world, lots of leaders in particular, who are relatively evil, either because they're corrupt or they're brutal or they're not as democratic as they ought to be, or they throw their weight around. The United States has had leaders that, who could be described as relatively evil in that sense.
Well, not as bad as the rulers of Myanmar or of North Korea or any number of – or Robert Mugabe. I mean, these are awful people, but we haven't talked about going to war with them.
Well, it's that's true. And when you say not as bad, I wouldn't – it's sort of angels dancing on the head of a pin to try to make a distinction between a Robert Mugabe, who's nothing more than a thug in office, and a president who would kill 2 million Vietnamese for no good reason at all, or at least 100,000 Iraqis on the basis of a claim of weapons of mass destruction and so forth that was false. So the point, however, I think, is that what we do when we describe evil enemies is we tend to talk about them in terms of absolute evil, of being satanic.
And the next Hitler.
The next Hitler. And if an enemy is satanic, like Saddam Hussein was portrayed as the devil, that means they're outside of history. That means there's no historical reason for them to behave as they do, because the devil is the devil because he's the devil, because he's evil by nature.
We have a clip from President George H.W. Bush on the occasion of the first invasion of Iraq. Let's listen to what he had to say about Saddam Hussein.
Just 2 hours ago, Allied air forces began an attack on military targets in Iraq and Kuwait. These attacks continue as I speak. Ground forces are not engaged. This conflict started August 2nd when the dictator of Iraq invaded a small and helpless neighbor. Kuwait, a member of the Arab League and a member of the United Nations, was crushed, its people brutalized. 5 months ago, Saddam Hussein started this cruel war against Kuwait. Tonight, the battle has been joined.
Well, yes, well, the U.S. ambassador, whose name was April Glaspie, to Iraq, had a famous conversation with Saddam Hussein and Tariq Aziz, his foreign minister, who's, by the way, about to be executed, looks like, in which she said, the United States has no interest in your dispute with Kuwait. Well, Glaspie was after this, and Saddam Hussein then invaded a week later. After this, Glaspie was coming from her hotel in England to go somewhere, and she was descended upon by a couple of reporters, who I think were from the Independent, who asked her, "Why did you say that? Or what did you mean? Or did you give him permission to invade?" And Glaspie's answer was, "We didn't expect him to take the whole country." I think that's a fascinating answer, because then the follow-up question — she got in her car, and there was never a follow-up question. The follow-up question would have been, "Well, what did you expect him to do?" And I think the answer was, they expected him to take the Rumaila oil field. They knew Iraq was bankrupt following the Iran-Iraq war. They knew Kuwait was rolling in dough. They knew that the Kuwaitis were slant drilling into the Rumaila oil field, which is on the border between the two countries.
Saddam Hussein had a legitimate beef there.
Yeah, that he had a legitimate beef. And so if he had just made an incursion, which I think may have been expected, and taken that oil field, there would have been a lot of finger wagging and denunciations, but there would not have been a war. When he went in and took the whole country, The next thing that happened was he realized pretty quickly that he'd made a mistake, and he tried to get out. In the end, he was offering to withdraw unconditionally, without even a face saver, if he could just withdraw, take his troops out of Kuwait and bring them back to Iraq. He would get out. At that point, George H.W. Bush said, "We'll see him in Baghdad." And then we understood that the point of that war was not to get him out of Kuwait. The point was to destroy the Iraqi armed forces and to eliminate Iraq as a major player in the region.
Although we held back, and some people were critical at the time, that we didn't wind up toppling Saddam Hussein then. But he became the most evil man in the world, and then we could believe that he had weapons of mass destruction, that he was trying to build an atomic bomb, and that he was supporting the 9/11 terrorists.
That's right.
Anything that went wrong was could be laid at his doorstep.
Yeah, we held back from toppling him. We did not hold back from destroying his armed forces. We did a pretty good job on his armed forces, tanks and military vehicles equipped with bulldozers buried Iraqi troops alive, the ones that didn't run fast enough. So it was a pretty brutal war, but it did stop short of eliminating Saddam Hussein, that's for sure.
My guest is Richard E. Rubenstein. His book, Reasons to Kill, Why Americans Choose War, is published by Bloomsbury Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You mentioned the invasion of Grenada earlier. Maybe we should listen to what President Reagan said on the occasion of that invasion.
Grenada, we were told, was a friendly island paradise for tourism. Well, it wasn't. It was a Soviet Cuban colony being readied as a major military bastion to export terror and undermine democracy. We got there just in time.
So this was another case of the evil enemy.
Yeah, definitely. A bald-faced lie, you know. But I think it's important, though, to make this point, that when Americans accept these arguments, when they go for war, I don't think it's because they are simply duped into going to war. I don't think it's because they're stupid or gullible, nor do I think that they do it because they like to fight. You know, because we think we're still Indian fighters. I think it's almost always an appeal to our moral sense that gets us into a war. And self-defense for us is a moral argument. I mean, self-defense is considered a sacred right in our country. My book is really a plea. It's not so much if I weren't convinced that we were fighting too many unjust and unnecessary wars, I wouldn't have written the book. But it's not so much an anti-war book in the sense as it's a plea to people to my country people, to think more clearly about these justifications of war, to be as skeptical as Americans are traditionally supposed to be, to say, I'm from Missouri, show me.
Well, this has led us into another one of your explanations for war that's unique virtue. We have a moral right to make war because we're disinterested liberators and peacemakers.
Yes.
And there are places where there are real problems, and we have to go there and help those people, whether it's Haiti or Bosnia or Somalia or Grenada or Iraq. Christopher Hitchens, I think, was arguing on this show not all that long ago that was the reason we should have gone in, because Saddam Hussein was an evil dictator.
Yeah. Well, if only we would help Haiti, that might be a justification for intervention. I mean, there are places that are basically part of our property almost.
Well, we've sent the U.S. military into Haiti.
We have.
I think any other country.
It's been part of the empire since at least 1915, and yet it's desperately poor. So the problem here is that we sometimes convince ourselves that we are by nature liberators and not occupiers. Appeals are made to us to stop atrocities from occurring in foreign countries, in countries that are sometimes close to our shores and sometimes not so close. And the appeal is made that we, unlike every other people in the world, we have no self-interest in this, that we just liberate because we're good, because we're liberators. And then, as a result of this, shall I say, a kind of denial. It's a denial that we are a self-interested nation, that we, in fact, are a self-interested empire at the moment. That sort of denial produces atrocities like what happened in the Philippines when we liberated Cuba from Spain. And the Spanish were doing terrible things to the Cubans. Having gotten rid of the Spanish, not only did we not permit Cuba to become truly independent, but we then annexed Spain. And then annexed the Philippines. And when the Filipinos rebelled against our occupation, we did exactly the same thing to the Filipinos that the Spanish had done to the Cubans, including torture of insurgents, waterboarding, concentration camps, killing hundreds of thousands of people, the whole nine yards. And what's so shocking about it is that we turn into kind of the mirror image, the dark image of the brutal people that we've tried to replace. I think there's something in this, I think it's a kind of psychological problem that we've got sometimes, that we can't admit our own defects, so we transfer them, we project our own defects onto other people and then pretend that we're perfect.
Well, during the last news report, we heard a soldier who was marching today as part of the Veterans Day parade say that this is a way to honor the people who have been preserving our way of life in this country. And we hear that a lot. How does that work in people's minds? How does going to Iraq help preserve and defend this country?
You got me. I don't know. I think what happens is that sometimes we find ourselves in an indefensible position. And, so instead of being able to say, well, we went to war to protect our freedoms, for example, or to protect our way of life, the reasoning becomes the reverse. We're at war, so therefore it must be to protect our freedom and our way of life. It's a way of trying to make ourselves believe that we're doing the right thing over there.
A listener, Steve in Brooklyn, writes in, I was surprised to learn recently that the ancient Romans only fought wars that were, in their view, defensive. Roman leaders went through the same elaborate ruses to argue to their public. So is this just something that's always been? Leaders always, they have to find a reason to get the public behind whatever they're doing, and that's the sort of thing they do. We're under attack.
Well, it could be. I think it's part of the imperial mentality, because the more the empire expands, the farther away the fighting gets, the more attenuated really the connection between our country and the periphery becomes, and the more it becomes clear that there are a few powerful interests that are making money off these wars, and that most people are, it's not for the benefit of most of us. Then
are you talking about the military-industrial complex?
Yes.
Because listener, Dave, actually wanted me to ask you about the role of that as a part of the – because it's such an important part of our economy.
Well, it is. But, it's very difficult to get any kind of a decent discussion about it. And it's long past time to talk about it because it's morally compromising all of us. We know in our hearts sometimes that – A, that the wars that we're involved in are really not justifiable, or that there are alternatives, that conflict resolution hasn't been tried and lots of things haven't been tried, so we don't have to fight. But at the same time, we understand that we've been practicing military Keynesianism, what some people call military Keynesianism, for the past 30, 40 years or more, since World War II, that without the demand factor that the military-industrial complex, or what my friend Seymour Melman used to call Pentagon socialism, without the demand factor that the military-industrial industries supply, this economy would be in more trouble than it is. And also, if you go through the Middle West, I had occasion to make a trip to southern Indiana and noticed all the trucks with support the troops signs and all the flags out. So doing a little field research in a bar, well, there's some guys drinking beer. I said, boy, you folks are really into supporting the troops. And the guy looked at me, you know, and he said, well, there are children. He said, there's nothing else to do here. We used to make auto parts or whatever. This is a deindustrialized area, and which means that not only do you have the military-industrial complex supplying demand to the economy, but you have the armed forces soaking up what would otherwise be jobless people. If we can't find a way to re-engineer the economy for peace, then it seems to me we'll never be able to look ourselves in the face. We'll always be in the position, which we are right now, of disapproving of wars but not really being willing to go to the mat to do anything about them. And in part, I think it's because we know we're cutting our own throats economically if we do.
Richard E. Rubenstein is the author of Reasons to Kill, Why Americans Choose War. It's published by Bloomsbury. He is University Professor of Conflict Resolution and Public Affairs at George Mason University. Thank you so much for being with us today.
A great pleasure, Leonard. Thank you.